This is The Conversation. It's a podcast that goes behind the scenes between the lines of contemporary art. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the show. I'm Michael Shaw. This is episode 291 with Virtual Cafe number 10 with Lee Wagstaff as our special guest. He is a past guest of the podcast, but has been very involved with Artist Support Pledge, and so wanted to find out how that's been going for him. And boy, do we get into it. Yeah, this is a longish episode, an hour and about 20 minutes. So I'm going to try to keep this intro short, but there are some very important updates that I want to get to before we jump into the episode proper. First of all, the website for this show is theconversationpod.com, where in this case, I highly recommend, and it is imperative, in fact, that you go to the episode page for this episode 291, because I have lined up most, though not all, 10 paintings of Lee's that he had a slideshow that went along with the presentation, and all but a few of them are included on the webpage, so 10 of them. The most relevant ones, certainly. I think he had maybe 14 or 15 total. You will not hear him saying, next please, because I cut all those out. But there are a few awkward cuts simply because of tech issues on various participants' ends. I'll get to more of that in a bit. First of all, I can't go on without thanking the core little group of folks who support the show via the platform Patreon. Thank you very much to all of you. I really appreciate it, including a new pledger. Thank you to you. And also want to send out a big thank you to Allison Widows for all of the back-end production work that she has been doing of late. Much appreciated. So before I get to a little more description of the episode itself, I want to let you know about a new format for this podcast that I am very seriously pondering, considering, and trying to make happen. We're basically talking about a scripted situation, not at all necessarily fictional, likely non-fictional, but something a little bit more narrative and story-based and just myself, maybe a co-host. That's something, if you have been around long enough listening, you've heard that campaign happened a year or so ago and didn't quite get anywhere. That's something that's still on the table, but I'm happy to just go forward on my own, basically being the narrator to various stories. In fact, I would like to take this opportunity to request or ask or put out there that if you are at all interested in something along these lines, that is to say a scripted version of The Conversation, and would like to contribute, this could potentially be a way to help shape future episodes of the show. So please do reach out if that intrigues at all, and I can fill you in more. It's not to say, I'm not saying that guest episodes are going away. In fact, another one is definitely coming up after this one. But it does get tiring after a while. And, you know, some of them are very rewarding and great and give a lot back, but some of them are draining and particularly ones that haven't aired and quite stressful. So no complaining, just saying that it's not as easy as it may seem. And I've been inspired particularly by a podcast that I started listening to fairly recently. You might have heard me talk about it. And then another one that I don't think talked about on the show before that are inspiring me to tell stories and, you know, again, real stories, but to tell stories as a way to make an episode. And I think it could be a way to not only mix things up, but find some more listeners, which is something that we haven't been doing much of late. So that's all FYI. Again, if you're intrigued and interested in potentially contributing to that, please do reach out. The Conversation, our podcast at gmail.com or social media or whatever you would like to, whichever way. And by the way, if you're not already following us at Artist Podcast on Instagram, or you can follow me, and or I should say you can follow me at Michael Shaw Art on Instagram. And if you would like to support the show, it would be much appreciated. You can go to theconversationpod.com/support. And there are various ways you can support the show there. All right. So one aspect of this episode that I think artists and particularly painters are going to really appreciate is if you don't know Lee's work, do check it out on his episode page or, you know, his website. It's really intriguing that he makes these oil on canvas or enamel on canvas paintings that are so detailed. They look like prints, graphically speaking. And I asked him about that during this virtual cafe, and he is not giving into that. And I think that could be a whole nother episode, like talking about why people don't reveal their secrets. We really don't even scratch the surface of that, other than him saying that, you know, it's not something he wants to talk about or share. And even his artist painter friends can't figure out how he does it. So that's one thing to look forward to. But bigger picture wise, it's really a look into his artist journey and survival and even thriving through Artist Support Pledge. Could we say thrival, survival and thrival? And we also have some great comments and questions towards the latter, say 45 minutes from about a handful of listeners. So and virtual cafe goers, regular virtual cafe goers. So you have that to look forward to as well. And I don't have the next virtual cafe planned, but I'm thinking, just to let you in on a hot update, I was just thinking earlier today, maybe the next virtual cafe we could plan to record and have it only be listener participants, and that could then become an episode. And we focus it in such a way that it is an interesting group conversation. Yeah, easier said, right? But it's worth a shot. So if you got any ideas for that, I'm all ears. All right. I think that's it. Let's finally jump into this virtual cafe number 10 with special guest Lee Wagstaff. Thank you very much for listening, and I look forward to hearing from you soon. And otherwise, you should be hearing from us from this podcast in a couple of weeks. Until then, be well.
So I'm Lee. I'm originally from the UK, from Essex, but now I live in Berlin. And today I'm here to talk about ASPs, Artist Support Pledge, not NFTs, although I do know quite a lot about that now, but that's another story. So let's go back to a year ago. I'm sure everyone would like to go back to a year ago. So just before the whole pandemic started, I was working on a show. Weirdly enough, it was called Pangolin because of the patterns and shapes in the paintings. And, you know, bizarrely, obviously, pangolins came into the news just in time for the wrong reason. So I've been working on this show. The show was kind of cancelled because of lockdown, although I did a virtual show because I have my studio space is also a shop front. And for quite a few years, I used it with a friend of mine. We had it as a gallery. So I quite often used to do shows, but for the last few years, it's just really been my studio and then occasionally my gallery space. So the show was cancelled or postponed, or I kind of postponed it because of just about to go into lockdown. And then I started to see on Instagram all these hashtags and posts related to Artist Support Pledge. And I thought, oh, this is quite interesting. And I never really get involved in any kind of online schemes or anything like that because it always seems to be a lot of effort. So I thought, oh, well, I can't have my show. I'll do a kind of virtual show. And then I thought, usually I would not sell my pictures. I don't know if you know much about the Artist Support Pledge, but it's a very specific idea and way of selling art for a certain price in a certain way. And usually I wouldn't sell my pictures as cheaply as that. But I kind of thought, well, you know, like many people, I imagined like doom was coming. And I thought, oh, you know, and like many artists, I don't really have much reserve. You know, I go from show to show. I think the kindest thing one of my friends said to me, oh, you're a jobbing artist, which literally means you go from one job to another, one show to another, and then you kind of survive in between. So I started to look into the artist support pledge, found out a little bit about it, and then I thought maybe I could incorporate the show that I just prepared with this. And it wasn't straight away, maybe it was a few weeks later. So the show was up and I was kind of gradually doing kind of online viewings and things like that. So most of the pictures in this show are the first few there, and a geometric, mostly in oil, some in enamel. But almost all the work I've done in the last sort of 10 years has really been experiments. I never really think of them as finished works. I kind of think, oh, I'm learning a new technique or I'm working something out. If you've heard the podcast, or as Michael knows, my main thing that I did when I was a student was more related to body art and performance, which I don't really do anymore. And then over the last few years, I would say that everything I do is kind of a test or experiment. And then when I have at least 10 of these tests, it becomes a show. So, or it has the potential to become a show. But with this body of work, I was kind of quite pleased with it because it was quite upbeat and optimistic for me. Like usually my work is a bit more gray and a bit more foggy and just not very bright and cheerful, whereas I thought this work was quite bright. So this is quite a bit more dynamic than I've been used to working in terms of mostly it's kind of a bit monotone. And I think it was a combination of a few things. I think, you know, the very beginning of the first lockdown, I think people didn't really know what to do. And a lot of people were stuck at home. I've been quite fortunate in that my studio is only 10 minutes away from where I live and I work on my own. So I could go every day to the studio. I wasn't really restricted by so much by the lockdown. I knew that the lockdown was coming because I've been following the news. And so I really stocked up on supplies, which again, I think was, you know, unusually for me, quite a wise move and quite forward thinking. So especially during the first lockdown, I had plenty of materials to work with and could kind of make the most of this. And then I can't remember exactly, I think I just dipped my toe into the artist support pledge right at the beginning. I think I put one or two images on and I didn't really expect very much because I never know what happens. And I always remember the adage, if you don't expect anything, then anything that happens will be quite positive. So,
somebody asked how big these are.
Oh, so almost all of them are around about 40, 50, I think. So the stretchers that I made myself are kind of weird shapes, like 53 centimeters by 41. Even though they were supposed to be 40, 50, but I'd made some stretchers during the summer, cut them by hand, and so they were a little bit irregular. But the standard size that I usually work on, which I really like, is 40, 50 centimeters. And I quite like these slightly deeper frames, like about 3.5 centimeters, because I kind of feel like they don't really need framing again, and they have a little bit of substance. But that's just the kind of quirk that I got into this thing. So I started to put these on and included them in this artist support pledge. And again, I didn't really know, I wasn't really that aware of hashtags or what their reach was. I mean, in the past, I'd always put like hashtag oil painting or hashtag, you know, geometry or something. And it never really had any effect. I mean, occasionally, I would get someone who likes skulls because I quite often do pictures of skulls and they would say, hey, neat skull. But I never really believed in the reach of hashtags because I'd never had great experiences. Occasionally, if I put a picture on, like in the 80s, I used to take pictures of indie bands. So 2 years ago, a year ago, when Genesis Peorage died, I'd taken some pictures of them in the 80s when I knew them a little bit. And I put that on and that hashtag and like hundreds of people replied to that because they were a very popular figure. But in general, I never really believed in the whole hashtag thing. I didn't really see it. I follow hashtags, but I never really benefited from the hashtag thing. So I put the work up. Yeah, so this is later. I mean, I do a lot of pictures of skulls. this is more typical to the work that I had done in the past, kind of skulls and parts of the body. And I mean, as I will say later, I did kind of, so the artist support pledge kind of took off. I think I put one or two pictures on at first, and then they sold quite quickly. And I thought, oh, this is a bit of a novelty. I mean, the price range for artist support pledge is around about in UK, £200, Europe, €200. And I think it's usually around 200 of your local currency. Obviously, if it's considerably more or less, I think you're supposed to adjust. But Matthew Burrows, who set up the artist support pledge, he has very clear instructions on the website. But people always think it's a difficult thing to get into, but really you're just posting a picture, using a couple of hashtags, and agreeing to sell something for around about the 200 mark. And then when you've sold five of your pictures, then it's kind of an unwritten contract that you buy another picture by another artist. So it's this idea of circular, you know, so that you're always supporting. And I found from the beginning that, you know, most of the people who bought the work at the beginning were artists or fellow artists that I was following or connected with. And then I noticed that I was getting a much wider audience or people interested from all around the world. Mostly, I would say the UK and the US were the people who were most, I think, I don't know if this was a timing thing when I was putting them on, but they were most of the people that were buying the work. And it was quite a learning curve because, you know, in the past, I don't sell huge volumes of art. And, you know, if someone buys a piece of my old work, then I pack it up, then I go to the post office, then I find out how much it's going to cost to post and all those kind of things. But in the last few months, I've really streamlined my way of working because, you know, with the restrictions, you have to learn about how to ship stuff and what the restrictions are. And from Germany to America, you can only send things premium in the post, which is asking people to pay about $60 to ship things, which for a picture that is already $200, it's like a quarter of the price. So it's quite a high amount. And I always send everything tracked and insured because I don't really want to be dealing with lost pictures or things not arriving, or at least not coming back to me if they don't arrive. And from the whole time, I only had one picture returned and no pictures lost so far, fingers crossed. And that was when Canada shut the borders and the picture came back. And also in the past, I always thought that my work wasn't particularly commercial or not desirable, because obviously I like my work. But I think with this work, it was a bit more, unintentionally, it was a bit more populist or accessible. And as an artist, I never really had that kind of work. It's always been a bit difficult to sell. I mean, I did sell work in the past, but it was to a certain kind of person that came to the studio or was into skulls or dark forests or something like that. And then when I started to work in this way, which was before Artist Support Pledge and before the pandemic, just because I wanted to make work that was a little bit brighter and more poppy, not necessarily popular. And then I suppose now this is probably a bit of it's not a compromise because I like making this work, but I suppose now that I know there is a certain audience for the certain kind of work, then, you know, I do swing a little bit towards that audience, but I never make anything that I don't like. I'm just, there's stuff that I do and I think, oh, people like this, so I'll do another one similar, or, you know, and in the past that never really interested me because I always wanted to move on. But I think, you know, like many artists, my desire has always to be sustainable and as independent as possible. And since being involved with the Artist Support Pledge, I feel a little bit like I have more control. I've done shows with galleries and I kind of have a gallery in London that I work with, but, you know, that's more or less a show every 2 or 3 years. And You know, I've always thought, you know, you just have to do things on your own. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of galleries in the past, and most of the time it's been a bit stressful. So it was always my desire to be my own gallerist, be the artist, and do all those things. And even the shipping, it's a bit of a chore, but I quite like doing the shipping because I know that I've packed everything really well. I know that it's insured. I know that I've done my best. And, you know, I've bought things from galleries before, and I've sent things to galleries, and things have got broken or smashed or whatever. And I know that if I'm doing it, I take 100% care, and I make sure. I mean, I think that's one of the things that has made me quite successful in the artist support pledge. And I've had a lot of repeat buyers because, first of all, without sounding big-headed, they're getting quite a good deal. They're getting a picture that I would normally sell, or in my idea, in my mind, I would sell for much more. They're getting, you know, so they're usually oil paintings. They're, I don't know, I think of them as, in the past, I was always a little bit like, I didn't like to sell things. I didn't really like the art to leave the studio because I was so invested in it. But I've had really nice responses from people. Like, people have been so happy with some of the things they've got. And I don't know, it's quite a new, I think that the thing that I like most about all artist support pledges is this direct contact with the collector or the buyer or the, you know, the person who's bought it. In the past with galleries, sometimes you find out who's bought the picture, but quite often it's just, you know, if there is at the opening or something. But in general, there's no real connection with that person. And then I get all these really nice messages from people saying, oh, it arrived today, it was very well packed, etc. I was doing these kind of pictures before, and I thought, oh, maybe they're too subtle, or maybe they're, I think in real life, they have a little bit more effect. But what's quite nice about these pictures, especially on Instagram, is that somehow the size and the optical effect works really well, because it's condensed to, you know, maybe 2 inches or 4-3 inches, however big most people's smartphone screens are. And so it has a similar effect to standing in front of it. You have this move in, move out effect. And this particular style, this line kind of became a formula. And especially last summer was like my biggest seller. I literally couldn't make them fast enough. And again, this, it kind of goes completely against the way that I believed the work in the past, because, you know, I went to art school in the 80s, 90s and 2000s, where you're completely instilled with a certain way of thinking about your work and a certain way of being about your work. And, you know, which I've come to realize, especially during this artist support pledge, that is quite a barrier. And I found this particular, for want of a better word, economic model to be quite liberating, because it's a direct link with people who are interested in your work, who are buying it. It's not too expensive that they aren't willing to take the risk. Because, you know, before this, I never really bought art online, because it's always nicer to see it in real life. But it's the perfect way for me to work. I'm not a very sociable person. I'm not really a kind of schmoozer. You know, I'm not beast, but I just don't really like the whole thing, and that can be detrimental in the art world, because it's all about connections and relationships. And, you know, and I take this opportunity to thank Michael, because Michael is, you know, persistent, and you are the person really that kind of brings me back all the time to the art community, because I listen to your podcast and I feel like a real connection with almost all of the people you talk to. And it's kind of like a weird fellowship, because I don't know those people, but I know them for an hour and I feel a real connection. We have some of the same experiences, and, you know, quite often I'm listening to that while I'm making the art. So this is quite a nice full circle moment. And, you know, I don't want to blow smoke, but, you know, I'm really impressed by the amount of energy and time that you never seem to get jaded by the whole art world. And, you know, that's quite inspiring, because I'm quite a jaded person. So thank you for that. Yeah, so the work, this particular picture was quite interesting because this was bought by I didn't know him before, but a really famous Chinese Hong Kong singer called Eason Chan, who he was at, he's very famous in Hong Kong and China. And when I Googled him, I think Madonna had pulled him on stage at her concert in Hong Kong or somewhere, and she wanted to grind with him, and he said no because his daughter was in the audience or something. But he's quite. So you never. I mean, before this, I had very certain people who bought the work, and you know, you gradually make connections over the years. But what was nice about this, I sold work to Hong Kong, to Australia, to Canada, all around Europe, and quite a lot to the USA. So, and also if you don't really want to, I mean, you can kind of experiment with the things that you put up there, and you don't have to sell things for the 200, it can be less. So if you have very small works, I think there are a lot of people who collect very small works. They don't have big houses or big walls, and you know, a lot of the artists that I follow, friends of mine who are working, most of them would not sell original paintings on canvas stretchers for this price. But it's a way that I've got used to working, and I like it. And I like the fact that I'm giving people good value. But not to say that a drawing isn't good value, because most of the things that I've bought have been very small pieces, because I like small work. And this is a particular format. Before the lockdown, I'd bought a certain number of canvases this size, and it was just, you know, something I kind of had a bit of a formulaic worker. I don't know as artists how much you're willing to sell things for, but the way that I thought about it was, you know, if I sell something from a gallery, usually I'm giving them 50% of what I'm selling. So that already raises the price of these to 400. And even though that's still a little bit less than I would normally have wanted before this, it's kind of been a real game changer in me being able to get through this whole situation without being in debt, being able to pay the rent, being able to buy materials, and just being able to continue working. So what I've sacrificed or compromised in the whole price range. And then you see, you know, I follow the art news, you see all these galleries folding and all this kind of thing. So, you know, I believe that I've made the right decision to follow this particular formula. And, you know, I'm very happy that I've connected with other artists and just other people, because I have a studio in Berlin. I've managed to get by for the last 10, 12 years, but I've never really put my head above water. I'm really not the kind of person that would do this beforehand, but it just seemed something that I thought, oh, you know, I give it a try, I'll just see what happens. And I've been really surprised by the response from people and just this sense of working. And I, especially when I've heard interviews with Matthew Burrows, he's a very serious kind of person. And I think, you know, he thought on his feet straight away and thought, how can we find a way for artists to survive during this time? And most of the artists who I know have more than survived. They've really thrived using this formula, and for whatever reason. And a lot of the artists that I've bought work from, I would say that they are, you know, semi-professional, just because also they have got on board. And I've noticed that a lot of craft people who don't have the same psychological restrictions of 10 years in art school to tell them that it's not okay, you know, to sell your work a bit cheaper and to sell it on Instagram. So I think a lot of craft people have done really well out of this. I follow a lot of ceramicists, and they're selling loads of work. And also, I really didn't know how long it would last for. I thought it was a bit of a bubble. So I thought, you know, I can work quickly, and, you know, things are selling. And, you know, if I sell a couple more, then, you know, I can buy this, I can buy this material, I can buy some more stretchers. And I really looked at it in that way of thinking, you know, a kind of what I'd always wanted, a sustainable I almost said the P word. A sustainable way of working. So
Lee, as I skip to the next picture, something that I can't be the only one wondering is, how do you apply oil or enamel to such small pieces with such small volume?
I knew that people were going to ask this, and it's kind of a bit of a top secret technique that I've developed over years, and I've been working on this. I've been working this way for I think about 5 or 6 years. So I had a lot of work in reserve because I've been experimenting. I mean, my background is in printmaking, but these are not prints. So all I will say is that all the paint is applied by hand, but I obviously have a few tricks and techniques. Nothing that you can't learn on YouTube, but if you want to learn it, you have to find out, because it took me a really long time to work out. And I'm generous in many ways as an artist, not in this way. But
Let me ask you this, Lee. Did you see a YouTube video that kind of sealed the process for you?
No, not really. But
so you had to do it on your own?
Yeah, I mean, I worked out a lot of things, and it took me, I would say, 2 or 3 years of experimenting, using different materials and different layering of materials. But I mean, anyone who has one in their hand could probably work out how I've done it, I think. And I think that's why a lot of artists have bought them, because I would say I get almost every day I get a question, I get a DM on Instagram, how do you do this? I can't believe you do this. I can't believe you work this fast. But what people don't know is that each piece probably takes a month from beginning to end. So it's quite a labored process. But the way that it works on Instagram, people think, oh, he's doing there's another 3 paintings on today. But what they don't know is that stuff that is on today, I started in December. So anyone who works with oils also knows that, I suppose you can make things cure or dry a bit faster. But in general, you know, this isn't oil, this is enamel, so this is quite fast. But I only really started working in oils a few years ago because I had a whole box of oil paint that someone gave me, and I literally didn't have any materials to work with. And I thought, oh, I would try oils. So,
Lee, and just one other question. When you see these in person, just to give people a sense, how graphic versus painterly do they look when you look up close?
The videos that I make in the storage, you can see up close, and you can see the brush marks of the gesso. So it really depends. And that's what I quite like about it, because it does make you question, because it's quite strange to be in the discussion of people online. How does he make this? Because, you know, before this happened, no one cared whatever I made. So it's quite interesting that people discuss, oh, how does he make this? And then someone's saying, oh, he's just printing them and this. And it kind of is quite interesting for me, because I know how I've made them, and I know how I didn't make them. And I'm quite happy if people go along the wrong route, because it means that they're further away from finding out my secret. But you can see the brush marks of the gesso underneath. You can see that it's not applied in that way. You know, you can, so it is quite confusing for people, which again, I kind of like, because, you know, when I was more of a body artist, I was much more contrarian, much more confrontational, but this is more of a subtle thing, because I would say that I haven't been a painter all my professional life. Probably only the last 6 or 7 or 8 years is working in this way. And so most of the people I know from university, they're all painters. And painters are a particular breed of person. They're very specific about this and that and the other. And one of my best friends, Stephen, he said, oh, as soon as I've got one in my hand, I can tell you how you made it. And he's got 2 of them now, because he's also in the pledge. And he still doesn't know how I've made them. And that's kind of quite funny for me, because, you know, I would not say that I'm a painter's painter. I would say that I'm a jobbing artist who's worked out a way of working with paint in an interesting and sometimes seductive way. And, you know, when I was at art school, I was in the printmaking department. So I don't know what it's like in the States, but printmaking is the Cinderella of the fine arts. It's the fourth in line after painting, sculpture, photography, printmaking. And I've always been in the printmaking department because of that fact, because you're free. You're free of the kind of restrictions and the sensibilities and even the discourse and scrutiny that other disciplines are, because people just say, oh, it's a mechanical what you do, you're a machine. And I kind of agree with that in a way, whether I'm working with the machine or not. It is a very mechanical, because it's about problem solving. It's about using the history of technology to make something. So I've always liked to be part of that thing, but these are not prints, not in the traditional way, not in the within the four disciplines. And I suppose what's useful about this work is that it works very well on Instagram, in terms of a lot of this work has this optical arresting look. So even if you're not particularly interested, if you're scrolling through, it kind of hits the retina in a way, which I suppose is also maybe another tip for the artist support pledge, is to have a really good photo of the image. And also you're only really having like maybe half a second of people's attention on Instagram, because, or even that if you're lucky, because people are scrolling through while they're talking and watching television or doing 100 other things. So I think that was another thing that worked quite well for this particular series of work. Yeah, you could go back to that's quite a recent one. And that was also bought by a painter, and he got it and he said, I still don't know how you did this. And yeah, so I'm quite pleased and proud that I am having a dialogue with other painters who would not normally have a dialogue with me, because they are buying the work to scrutinize it a bit more. And
what's the longest from the time that you started to the time piece was finished that you took with these small?
Sometimes I start in the summer. So like, and then I will be on sale in the November or December or something like that. It really just depends on the way that I mix the oil. So, and also when in the summer I can work outside. So I can work, and things cure a lot quicker in the summer. But if I'm building up lots of layers, then I like to do that in the summer. So probably the quickest I could, it's probably easy to say the quickest I can make things. So the quickest I can make something is maybe 3 weeks from start to finish. But there are some things that take maybe 2 or 3 months. It really just depends. So I've always got things on the go. Like I'm doing work now in 2 months' time. But that's the way that I've always worked. It's just now that I probably work at a larger volume, just because people are interested and people, I mean, I don't really like all these cliche things like seize the day or make use of the moment, but you know, I've had so many years of uncertainty and, you know, not being so tight on getting money for the rent and just for the general things. I've worked, I would say, I graduated 20 years ago and I've had so many ups and downs, but I've very rarely had any reserves. And that's partly because of professional decisions I've made, not necessarily about the work, but I've always been a bit reluctant to work in a certain way or to schmooze or to network or to do things. And whenever I've been given certain opportunities, I've always been slow to take them up. And I always thought if I get another opportunity again, then I would try and make the most of it. And it just so happened that this support pledge was an opportunity. And I thought, I didn't think it would last very long. I thought it would last maybe as long as the first lockdown and people would be enthusiastic because they're stuck inside. And but it's, I would say, and I stopped for a while because I thought I was kind of saturating, not my market, because I don't think about that, but I was just thought I was saturating all my friends' Instagram feeds, or I thought people maybe had enough of me. And you know, not every work sells, so they will probably be, you know, sometimes I will repost something maybe a couple of months later, or if it's a picture I really like, maybe even a couple of weeks later. I think Matthew talked about that a little bit in his talk. And having listened to his interview with you, I think I was taking it much too seriously. And I was, not that I think about my brand, because I don't really know what that is, but I think sometimes artists have an idea of themselves that they build up, or that other people have built up for them, and they have to stick to certain rules. And obviously, kind of one of the whole points of being an artist is that you don't necessarily have to stick to rules. But I know this, you know this, that you kind of get in your head that there is a certain trajectory, a certain way of working, a certain way that things are done. And if you don't work in that way, then somehow it's gonna damage you. But I always think with this work, it's work that I really enjoy making because it's technically and intellectually satisfying. And, you know, it sells, which did take me a while to get used to. And friends of mine who are not artists, they don't understand that. They, you know, because I don't think of myself as a sellout or anything like that, but, you know, being able to pay my rent, to pay my insurance, to buy more materials and to keep working is what I've always wanted to do. And I don't know how long this phenomenon will last, but I will make the most of it while I can. And I will try and maintain the relationships that I've made with people, because I've met some really, I'm in contact with some very nice people, people who are genuinely very interested in the work, who really enjoy it, and who are quite serious collectors, but they're not these kind of big collectors that normally you would want to try and come in contact with, or you believe that that's the people. But there are a lot of people who don't have huge amounts of money, but they're very passionate about collecting, especially small works, or especially something that they've discovered themselves, you know, discovered it online or through friends or something. And to me, that's also very special, because I'm not a hugely sociable person, but there's a guy in Holland who, funnily enough, this was a commission for, because I'd done something similar. And he said, oh, can you do something with Dutch artists? And so I have done a few commissions.
When you do commissions, I presume you raise the price?
No, not necessarily. If it's people who have bought pictures before, or if it's something similar to what I've done before, and quite often, again, they usually want it to be within the artist support framework, so they know that the limit on the price is 200. So I just usually say to them, tell them the time frame that it will usually be. You know, I usually say 4 to 6 weeks, and sometimes I've taken a lot longer. But I have had commissions for bigger works, and that's quite nice, because then I can take more time doing it, and people are willing to pay more for that. And through this thing, I've sold some of what I would call my more important pieces of work. Although this is one of my favorite things that I ever did. And this sold for 100 euros. I sold this for 100 euros, but it's one of the favorite ones that I did. I think I'm just kind of less attached to this work, because I see it within the frame. I suppose I compartmentalize between artist support pledge and what I would call my regular work, even though this is my regular work now at the moment. But I've also started to get like commissions for much bigger work, so like 2-meter pieces, and they take a long time to do. There's 4 that I'm working on, and they might take up to 6 months to do.
Let's turn it over to everybody, turn it over to Q&A. So Keely, what do you got?
So you'll have to forgive me, because I didn't listen to the other episode yet. So for those of us like me, if you could just please quickly say the shipping, it sounds like you're doing that additionally through your website. You're not having to pay for that inclusively within the cost of the work, I take it, absorb that yourself. And the other part, if you could just clarify the Instagram part of this, it's another profile belonging to this network of artists, or are you having to have a personal following and that's how you're selling your work?
Okay, so the shipping part of it, yeah, I'm in, because I originally thought it was just going to be EU people and UK, because I'm British, but I'm based in EU. I put the pictures for sale for €220, which is approximately the same as £200. And then I included included shipping in within the EU for that. Okay, so the second part is probably the most important part of getting people to see the work, is the artist support hashtag, this one word, because, you know, I put lots of other hashtags, geometric work, painting, et cetera, but that is really the key thing. But in general, that is, yeah, that is the one thing that was the game changer. Somehow Matthew got this so widespread so quickly, this hashtag artist support pledge. And then you put other things in, which maybe people like the style of the work or something. But, and usually there's a little bit of blurb you put under. So, you know, you're not really, it's always funny when I hear people talk about it, it's like they're joining the scheme, but all you are really doing is agreeing to kind of abide by the principles and putting a hashtag underneath the work that is for sale. It's not, there's no other real commitment apart from that. So if you don't sell something, you've not lost anything. You're not joining anything. If in future you want to delete those posts, you can. If the work doesn't sell and you want to put it back on a few weeks later, you can. It's just, you know, I think if I put things on at a certain time of day, I seem to get more of an American audience in the evenings to early mornings. If I put something on...
Why don't you go to Allison for her question. Allison.
Yeah, so my question is related to the way that I understand that it works, is that for every 1,000 euro, dollar, pound, et cetera, that you make, you're supposed to contribute a portion of that, in theory, to sort of going back and buying work of other artists. And so I'm wondering, like, how you feel about that, if it's been something that's been exciting for you to also, you know, participate in that. And, you know, I think it's a nice aspect of the model, you know, that he's tried to create there, sort of keeping it turning around, so to speak.
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, there are artists at different levels and different financial backgrounds. And I remember, especially at the beginning, a lot of people who were buying work were quite successful artists, like artists that I really liked. And, you know, all of a sudden I was really thrilled that a certain artist had bought my work. So there is that aspect to it. But for me, I suppose I've been able to, a lot of the things I bought have been ceramics, and I don't really know much about ceramics, but I was just small things, because quite often things were big or they were from far away. I wanted to try and get things that were as local as possible, or, you know, and also I don't have huge space to store things. And having run an art gallery for 8 years, I have a whole gallery full of work that has not been collected, really big pieces that I will probably have to look after for the rest of my life, even though they're best friends of mine who can't be bothered to come and collect them. So if I was going to start a collection, I wanted it to be small pieces that I could put away nicely and bring out nicely, and not something that would be like a literal weight around my neck. But again, and also the things that I've looked at have quite often been people who don't have huge followings, or maybe are not quite early in their career, and just things that I like. And it has been a bit of a struggle sometimes that you have to look through. There is a lot of work in there. It's quite a big pool. But there are some really nice things, and there are some work that, again, I think maybe would be completely lost without this, or not have a platform to work. You know, just like little drawings, and you think that person's got a lot of skill or a lot of talent, or just it's an aesthetic that pleases me. And then there's other people that, there was one artist that I bought some work from, Helen Booth, and I didn't really know much about her, but she's really quite successful now. Even within the last year, she's had some big shows all over the place. So it's really like, you know, buy something that you like, and, you know, just keep it or put it somewhere and keep it precious. But yeah, that's, I think that was the thing that helped it to catch on very quickly, that particular aspect of the economic strategy or whatever you can call it. Because, and also I think you can interpret that as you like there were times when, you know, I didn't necessarily buy an artwork, or I would give that to a particular charity or a particular charity working with art. Sometimes that's an easier thing for me to do, because then I don't have to arrange all the packaging and, you know, all the shipping and that kind of thing. But, you know, obviously it's an honor system. It's a bit like riding the Tokyo subway. You know, you could step over the line, but it's probably better to get a ticket. And it, and also I don't think you necessarily have to do it exactly on the day that you sell the fifth picture. You know, you know what you've bought, you know what you want to do. And so, yeah, I think it's just about, the idea of it is a nice thing. And I think for people who are not, who are collectors, I think they genuinely feel that they are contributing to artists. And for other artists, most of us know what the, how it works. You know, most of us know that you have ups and downs, and you know, any interest from anyone can be just a nice thing. And you think, oh, this person's bought my work. I was really excited when a certain person bought my work, and yeah, I think it's a nice thing. And I think that's, that was really a key to get, especially at the beginning, to get the whole thing going. And when I've listened to talks from Matthew, he's talked about how in his circle, his London circle, he doesn't know anyone that doesn't have work from this scheme. And so, and I think also there have been a lot of canny collectors who've realized that they can get some nice pieces quite cheaply and still feel good about it, you know. So it's, like I say, I don't think it's a losing situation. You have to judge what you feel something is worth or what you need in the particular moment. And again, you can dip in your toe in however you like, small studies or the biggest piece of work in your studio. I mean, the way that he talked about it at the beginning, it was almost like it was a car boot sale. He thought about it in terms of, you know, that when this pandemic happened, there'd be a lot of artists who would be, if they were temporary teaching, they would be losing their work. Because I don't know about in Paris or in America, but in the UK, a lot of people are on these contracts where if they don't work, they don't get paid. Even at universities, they are not on full-time contracts. So as soon as the shutdown happened, there were a lot of people who were regarded as quite successful artists in teaching positions who all of a sudden had no work. And so he talked about, you know, what do artists have? Almost every artist has like a surplus of work, whether it's their best work or, you know, their average work that they have available. It's an asset that only comes into value when someone values it. And, you know, again, fortunately, I had lots and lots of work that I've done in the past, nicely packed away in my drawer. And it was it's also a good opportunity to revisit things. And, you know, you can see something, if you don't like it and no one else likes it, you just delete it from your Instagram and never have to think about it again. So, yeah.
I'm just going to throw in a one big overview of Artist Support Pledge. The takeaways that I had from talking to Matthew and subsequently what other people said about it is, one, you already have to have a pretty substantial following, which you clearly did. And two, your work has to translate well to the platform. So I think if you don't have those two things, it's my sense is it's going to be a struggle to be selling regularly.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I suppose I do have an okay following, but the people that I've bought work from, they just have a couple of hundred following. And there are some people who I know who have done really, really well out of it, and they don't have really big followings. I think communication is very important key. You know, once you get the ball rolling and you sell one or two pieces, you will quite often get people come back. They will recommend it to their friends. And I think there is one woman who has bought 10 pieces from me. And so And fortunately, she lives in Germany as well, so that was quite easy to ship. But even today, she wanted to buy another piece that had already sold. So again, I wouldn't see that as a barrier because I didn't think about it at the beginning. I had an okay following before this happened, but it didn't translate into very much. You know, people sent me nice messages and occasionally I sold things, but I don't know exactly how the Instagram algorithm works, but I think posting regularly is as important as having a big following, whether that's 3 times a week or every day or something. I know it's a chore. I know that a lot of people wouldn't normally do that. But again, these are kind of challenging times. And if posting on Instagram a little bit more than you used to is a compromise, it's not such a big compromise, is it? So I think Matthew knows much more about how this works, but he mentioned that. And I found that I had a big break over Christmas and the new year, and it took a couple of weeks for things to build up again. But I do try and post every day. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, you could even be a story. And I think stories are a little bit more important now for some people because there's so many adverts in Instagram now, it can kind of become a bit of a chore. I mean, I would somehow agree with the translation of the image online because there are some very, but then there's a guy that I follow who does these very, very subtle graphite drawings, and it's pure graphite on paper and you have slight folds in the paper. And he's sold a lot of work. And I'm sure that in real life, they're amazing, iridescent, but they're kind of a little bit flattened on Instagram. So again, I think even quite simple or what would be less Instagram friendly work, if you photograph it in a certain way or present it in a certain way with close-ups, so you can have up to 10 images. If people are interested in your work enough to buy it, they're probably interested enough to swipe through. So, I mean, I don't think you have to worry too much about the casual people because they're probably not going to buy your work. Or there are some people that keep promising to buy the work and it's like 6 months later, they actually buy it. You know, there's not that many time wasted, but there are some people who get excited about it and say, oh, I definitely want this. And you quite often get people asking, can you reserve this, which I've done a lot, and then you don't hear anything for them. So I usually reserve things for a week or something if I think they're serious, and then it goes back in the shop. And I say that to them. I say, you know, I'll reserve it for you. And another thing that I can do on my website is take it off of public view and give them a link only to it. That's another thing which I worked out how to do. So, I mean, I have become a little bit more website savvy, but I've been really lucky that someone has been able to do that for me. So again, if you can't do it yourself, there are lots and lots of web people out there who will help you. I mean, you might have to pay them like you did in the old days, but again, it's part of the whole system, isn't it, really? You know, everyone keep going and everyone trying to help each other. So I would really encourage people to, even if this wasn't happening, to have as good a website as they want and as good a website as they would like to visit of other people's, in terms of being able to communicate with the artist, being able to buy stuff from the artist. And also in your web shop, you can also have stuff that is not artist support pledge. So things that are much more expensive, or, you know, that you don't want to sell for cheaper, because, you know, once people get into the habit of visiting your website or looking at your work, and like I say, I've sold work that's not part of that to people who have been attracted by this. So even if you use this as a way to get eyes on you, then it's not a bad thing. And another thing, you know, as someone with a printmaking background, there's no reason why, you know, artists that would not normally do this couldn't either do a set of prints, or, you know, if that could be within your price range of what you think is right, you can do an edition print or something, which again is not a compromise. You know, there are lots of great printmakers out there who can help you, or if you are printmakers as well, monoprints. A friend of mine only does monoprints on his kitchen table, and, you know, he's selling those for 200 euros, because What's interesting is you have a real huge audience, potential audience, because you it's a little bit like, I suppose, it's like gambling, but the risk is very low to you, because you know that if you have an exhibition, even with if it's with an okay gallery, you pay a lot of money to get the work together, to get it there. I mean, people have this idea that, like your last guest on the conversation, that the gallery is going to lay everything on for you, that all you have to do is just turn up with your lovely picture. That's not true. You know, you have to get the shipping, you have to get the work there, you have to, everything is up front. And then even if you do sell anything, you don't see that money for like 6 months. So if you're lucky, you know, if the gallery doesn't go out of business and the person doesn't completely disappear, which again, I've had happen to me. So, you know, from a art school point of view, in some ways, this seems like a step back initially. But for me, I really feel like it was a huge step forward in changing the way I thought about making art, or I thought about surviving as an artist.
Oh, good. Sorry, Lee. I wanted to let Jennifer jump in.
Hi, Jennifer.
Actually, this kind of goes to what you were just saying, like changing the way how I thought about making art, and changing the way how I thought about, I guess, promoting art. So there was something that you mentioned during your talk that was along the lines of like, I don't like to schmooze, I don't like to meet people in person. But I think what's really powerful about this, and especially what you did for this community, is the importance of social media now. So it's kind of given a platform or enabled people who are more, let's say, antisocial or introverted or whatever, it's kind of bridging like this equity gap so that they have this new platform where they feel more comfortable socializing, where they feel more comfortable sharing their art, where they feel comfortable to sell their art. And I think that's really magnificent with all this, is that you no longer, like going back to what you were saying about changing the way you think about promoting your art. Well, you don't have to go. I mean, now everything is pretty much, so you no longer have to go out and do it in person. You can do it online, and you've proven that you can successfully do so. I know that during coronavirus, the rumor was that more art has sold during this time than ever before. And I can see in my own practice that I've sold more than ever before. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with things like the Artist Support Pledge, which, you know, I tried to dip my toes in as well. And I think, you know, more people are staying at home, so they're tired of looking at their Target art, I guess. I don't know, but they want more nicer things to look at home. So I think that it's been a really great movement, and it really shows like the power of social media and how it can benefit a lot of people that aren't great at being in person or meeting people in person.
So. Jennifer, let me ask you something, Jennifer. Why do you think the pledge hasn't caught on in the States yet, if it ever does?
At least, like, I've seen it as that it had. I thought it had from my Instagram feeds and stuff.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you know people who are sort of, that's their main source of income in the States?
Through the Artist Support Pledge? I honestly don't know many artists that art is their main income in general, which is, like, my next, like, that's what I'm seeking out next, is I want to meet more artists. Because apparently 1 out of 10 artists in the States only makes a living from their art. So I know that this exists. So I think it's about like finding these folks, because I think, and learning from them, like how it's possible. And I mean, I have a coworker who gets paid $50,000 a year to work for an artist. So I'm like, how much is that artist making that he can afford to pay you $50,000 a year? Well, apparently those folks exist. So it's about digging them up. But I thought it had caught on. I didn't know that it hadn't.
My sense is that it hasn't. I mean, certainly at the very least, it hasn't the way that it has in Europe. Martin says, Jennifer, you said you stepped your toe in. Did it not work for you?
Jennifer. It didn't. But you know what? I personally find that when I'm making work with the intention of selling it, so I had to scale down my work and make it very small to make it fit the $200 mark. And I find that every time I make work with the intention for somebody else, for it being for somebody else besides myself, it doesn't catch on. So I think that's a lesson for me to learn about, like, you have to be true to yourself. You have to make work that works for you.
Yeah. And that sort of circles back, brings us back to what's really interesting about what Lee's doing. One of the more memorable things that you said, Lee, about this project or this extension of your work is that you described your support pledge work as like this side, you know, this other project or this other avenue is the word I was looking for of your work, as opposed to your sort of main art, you know. And I think that's interesting. And I think it's also very, you said at one point too, this is another notable thing you said in your presentation, that you didn't feel like you were selling out. And I think that's a very fluid definition. You know, I bet, you know, I would imagine that's something you grappled with at some point and you managed to sort of come to a point where, I'm putting words in your mouth, but I'm just assuming that you came to a point in your work where you thought, you know what, if this is keeping the rent checks coming or whatever, you know, source of your income you want to use, then, you know, and I get to have freedom and I get to make my work, then that's fine. Some version of that, is that, am I in the ballpark, would you say?
Yeah, a little bit, but now it kind of feels a bit blurred because there are certain things that I think, oh, this is obviously really commercial. I know that this would look really nice on a wall. I mean, but I've had, like, I would say 12 years of my career of thinking, no one's ever going to buy this. It makes me happy. I think it's interesting. It satisfies. And I've always been a little bit apologetic. And, you know, I did an MA at the Royal College of Art, and they're kind of supposed to build you up and tell you, you know, that you're all these things. And it's not about being insecure, because I've always liked the work I've made and it's always made me happy and always fulfilled. But I've resigned myself to the fact that, you know, my conversation is with dead artists of the past, and I'm trying to make work that is in conversation with that and maybe has a little bit of relevance to today. But I've never really thought about having a conversation with today's viewer. I don't know, it's kind of a bit of a strange thing. So a bit like Jennifer, you know, I've always made work for myself, but everything that I've done within this has been an aspect of stuff that I've made before. I suppose what's different about it is there are certain things that people like more, like the pictures of the faces and the lines, which, you know, still kind of give me a kick to do. I don't get really excited when I do them, but when they're finished, I think, oh, that one works really well. But, you know, and there are certain other pictures, a bit like the Rembrandt picture, which was kind of more of an experiment. And I thought, you know, as a comment on something that is quite successful. So there are some things that, you know, when I sell them, I feel a bit sad because I think, oh, I would like to keep that. And that's the kind of reference point in my thing. But then I think, oh, this is in someone's house who collects art, and more people will see it in their house. And, you know, he commissioned me to do something else. And so I think this kind of letting go of certain things. And also, I have tons of stuff I've made over the last 20 years. So, you know, like I said, I always said to myself that if I had the opportunity to sell more work, then I would do it. It's not like, I mean, yeah, maybe I was making the Lee Wagstaff mausoleum or something, but again, you know, when it's winter and you think, should I put the heating on today or shouldn't I? But I've had the heating on most days this winter, or maybe I've been so busy that I don't need it on because I'm rushing around so much. So it's like, I know that I can pay the gas bill this year, and it's kind of a bit trite and silly to say, but it's a luxury, and it's all the choices I've made in my career have been mine. You know, I've had opportunities and I haven't quite run with them, and this time I ran with an opportunity, and it's going to give me, you know, been able to buy equipment and stuff that I would never have bought before. I've got nicer paints now because I can, not just because I can buy them, but also because they work better. So, you know, there's lots of things that have improved. And Yeah, but even before this, I always had a problem selling work because, first of all, I thought it was kind of a bit of a part of me and I didn't want to give it to anyone, even for money. And then another part of me, like, it's really the economics of being an artist is something that really wasn't addressed at my art school. And this was the Royal College of Art, and I graduated in 2000. So it's not like centuries ago. There was all these huge art markets in 2000 when I graduated. So,
Jennifer had another comment. Go for it, Jennifer.
Sorry, Lee, I keep interrupting you. But actually, I wanted to echo what you said, because when you started the Artist Support Pledge and I began noticing it.
No, I didn't start it. I'm just a participant. Matthew started it. So, yeah, no, it's not me. I don't want to take credit for that.
Oh, well, I was going to say that it seemed very genuine. Like, it seemed very, like all the work that you're doing and participating in it and gaining success from it, it seems very genuine. It seems like it's your path. And I think as artists, we all have different paths. Like, some of us, you know, are meant for the Artist Support Pledge. Some of us are meant for something else. I know Michael was mentioning before, some work doesn't look good online and some work doesn't look good on platforms like Instagram. And I think that's a prime example of a different path, needing a different path, needing a different venue to show it. And I just kind of wanted to point out, because this is something that I'm always reminding myself of, is to be true to myself. Like, as artists, we all need to be true to ourselves and find like what our purpose is. Like, why am I here? What work should I be making for me that then will be shared with the larger public? And like, what is the best way to do that and perform that that's going to genuinely make me happy? Just like all the work that you said you created genuinely made you so happy you didn't want to sell it. So I think that's really beautiful.
So. Yeah, I think when Matthew started about it, because he's had a lot of time working in education and galleries, so I think he is really the beginning of a change, and I really hope that his initiative is the beginning of a change, because I think it's been a wake-up call for lots of artists who struggle to have a more continuous, you know, I don't think there are not many artists that have trouble making work, regardless of whether it's their most successful work or whatever. What artists really struggle with is maintaining a continuous way of surviving, of maintaining. And it's also, you know, when you sell work, it's not that I necessarily need an affirmation, but it can be quite useful, you know, especially if it's another artist or someone that you respect and you look at their other collection and you think, it's a nice feeling. It's good positive feedback, you know, even not that I necessarily am looking for that, but if someone who likes the work, who wants to live with it and, you know, is willing to pay for it, that's a kind of exchange that artists have been doing for centuries. But somehow during the 60s and 70s, art and making a living from your work outside of the respected structures has always been a bit problematic for artists, that you must do this residency, you must show with this gallery, you must do this. And I think it's not very realistic. And of course, you only hear about the huge success stories or the novelty stories in BuzzFeed or any of these things, but it's very rare you hear about, you know, less well-known artists or something or other. And weirdly enough, I follow a lot of auctions, like especially Phillips and Christie's and things, because I was in one a long time ago. And what I like looking about this is you see lots of work that doesn't end up in museums. And I'm often surprised, not by the high prices that work goes for, but the low prices or the art that is not sold by supposedly very hot artists, like especially very well established or very well known artists. A lot of their work doesn't sell. And you know that, you know, there are lots of deals and things going on behind the scene in auctions. So I think sometimes we have a little bit of a false perspective of success and money and where the money comes from. And obviously, I mean, I follow lots of very big artists on Instagram, like Daniel Ashram and all these people. But I think the real way that they work and the real way that their money comes is not in the way that most people would imagine. So, you know, the thing about artist support bridge and, you know, artists like us is, I suppose we know the more realistic side of being an artist. You have a qualification, you give a certain amount of time in your life to education, and then you commit, because a lot of artists don't even make it to continuing after they graduate. There's lots of artists I know who are really great artists, better artists than me, and they make different choices in their life. It may be family, it may be something else. And, you know, they don't even continue. And the ones who are in their 40s, 50s or whatever and are still going, like you say, there's a reason that they keep going. The reason why they don't compromise in their life. They choose art above comfort, above social niceties, above so many things. And it feels like for once, that commitment is kind of not rewarded, but at least valued in this situation.
To James's comment, I just wanted to say that I think there's a sense that a lot of these sort of sexier, more famous art historical figures weren't doing this like brass tacks hustling like we have to do these days. I think there are more of us now, but I think the folks who were like make it to the top, they're hustling the whole way up. And they're doing a lot of this like what feels like unglamorous entrepreneurial type stuff, and they're savvy. So I think those stories don't get told as much because they're not as like cool as, you know, people making 70 million in one day with NFTs or whatever, but like it's happening all the time. Everybody's doing it. And also I would say to that end, I think art schools are getting a little bit more pragmatic about teaching that straight out the gate. Like if not in undergrad, definitely by the master's level, there's a lot of seminars nowadays that are like specifically for launching you into art careers. And they contain all of these kinds of things. If you get the good advisors, good professors, they usually are getting better and better at providing that information, realizing that they had a loss of that information when they were in school. So I think it's shifting. It's maybe not as talked about, but I think that unglamorous work is taking place all the time. Nobody likes
it. Yeah, and Keely, I want to piggyback on what you're saying too, because I think a lot of people who are savvy and making a living are not necessarily making good work out there. Actually, they're the kind of people who haven't gone to school. They're street artists and, you know, hustlers and schlock artists and so on. So it's kind of there's a lot of bad and a lot of good, and it's all mixed together. And by the way, Beeple, who you referred to, aka Mike Winkelmann, who I just became familiar with because he was profiled in the New York Times a couple weeks ago, prior to this actual sale. I'm curious, Lee, are you familiar with him? And you know, do you have any strong opinions about him or any other artists along those lines?
Yeah, I do know him quite well because I've been following him for a couple of years on Instagram. And he is, like, I don't think people realize he's a really generous artist. Like, he works with Cinema 4D and a lot of 3D programs. And he does lots of tutorials on his websites and things like that. So he's not like someone, you know, and people say he's come from nowhere, but he has like a million followers. And also he I don't know if you look through his Instagram feed, he's very political. Like when you had the election coming up, and for the last election, he made lots of caricatures, and, you know, they're sometimes very grotesque, his things. And I'm not sure if it's the kind of art I would like to live with, but I think he's generally misunderstood because he's just come into the public domain like this. But he's been around for, you know, for a long time, and like I say, he's not just someone that just throws work out there without thinking about it, and he's not someone that's not heavily involved with his community. It just so happens that his work, you know, this kind of 3D animated work, is very popular with the hype beast kind of people. But I think he's just as generous to someone who's learning these programs, and he does lots of podcasts and tutorials. And I've actually seen online the work that was sold with those NFTs. And some of those NFTs were sold for $1 in the thing. And they're really beautiful artworks. The way they're presented in this most amazing packaging and boxes and things. And whether you paid $1 or $6 million, you still got the same package. And it's a particular aesthetic taste, but I think he's a very thoughtful person, and, you know, he will always be overshadowed by this whole buzz that's going around. And, you know, I don't think for a while, he's going to be in the canon of what we think of as art from our art school experiences. But then there are a lot of like people of color artists and people like that who are only coming into the canon now, and they were doing amazing work 30, 40, 50 years ago. So, you know, I'm not one to say, but having followed him for a couple of years, and that's really how I found out about NFTs, was because I followed him, because I kind of thought his work was interesting. And, you know, and his work is, it can be very grotesque. It would be like Hillary Clinton riding on top of Kim Jong-un, and then Donald Trump would, and there would be robots. And it's kind of bizarre, but it's worth looking at. And if you look at it in context of the time, and you have to remember that he posted a piece of work every day for 12 or 15 years. So, you know, he's a very dedicated and skillful artist. So, yeah, I think he's interesting, but I wouldn't necessarily want to have his art, but I enjoy what he does.
Yeah, well said.
I don't have anything burning, but I can share a little bit of information from talking with our friends. We have some friends who do own a gallery, and they said that this last year has been their best year yet in sales. So speaking about what you guys were discussing earlier, and they said a lot of it is people who normally would be traveling and spending their money eating out and doing all these different things and on items have this extra cash, and they're stuck in their house, and they're suddenly looking at their wall that they never bothered to put art on. And so there's a huge increase in sales there. So that kind of goes hand in hand with some of you who are commenting about selling much more work this year than in past years. And then also many years ago, I spoke with a gallerist told me that after their first show, like major solo show, it's usually only about 1% of those artists can continue making artwork. So what you guys were discussing about watching someone for a while to see if they actually have the lasting power and the interest and are going to continue making, that's definitely seems to be a part of the market and what people are looking for. Personally, my feelings, I'm kind of more interested in controlling my own work because dealing with outside galleries and stuff like that, I have experiences much like Lee and many other artists that I've known who've never gotten work back, never gotten paid, didn't get paid the right amount, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so I think you can look at both as a positive thing, but having being able to control your own work by being able to sell it directly online or through a website or any of the other like online portfolio systems that exist is a really powerful tool, I think, for artists because they can control it better. You can get more income from it than you would if someone else was taking a cut. And the on the topic of success, because I've been thinking about that a lot as well. I was given an example, a very famous artist who gets written up a lot. She worked for 2 years on a show in a New York gallery. The show sold out for, I think it was $150,000. We're not talking millions, of course, but $150,000. And then they said, well, so she gets half of that because the gallery takes half, $75,000 is what she takes home. Well, a studio and living in New York for 2 years, there's like virtually no profit. You know, so she's also a professor. So when we talk about in America, like being someone living and working off your art, like, you know, and someone who's a successful artist, what looks like successful from the outside, you know, doesn't necessarily translate financially on the inside, you know. So I think just keeping an open mind, and like Lee was saying, you know, he went to that one photographer's studio that was only 5 feet wide, you know, just that artists are always trying to kind of make do. And for me, having a notion of success that's kind of in line with what I want to be or do is I found much healthier than kind of having this outside view and looking at other people's success from an outside perspective when maybe it's not really, you know, what you think it is. That that whole grass is greener thing doesn't always play out when you know the back end details. So
yeah, just awesome, some comments. Awesome, Kimberly, actually. And I don't know, you haven't heard the last episode of the podcast, have you?
No, I haven't heard that. Well,
Katarina Wong, it's a first of a two-part episode. We talk literally about the grass is greener when it comes to success and artists. So just, tooting my own horn, but making reference to something that's kind of an ongoing conversation.
More thing, you guys mentioned social media, and yeah, it has a lot of negative. For artists, you can find your group or your niche. And so like Lee was talking in his podcast about how he doesn't have a lot of people who can talk about what he is interested in, you know, at a dinner party, but online you can find people who have similar interests and they might gravitate towards your work as well. Like social sphere that can be positive in that way. So it's just something to add to that.
Thank you, Kimberly. So I'm going to start.